We first tasted it back in ancient China as a fermented fish sauce called keqiu. When our traders got their hands on it, they distilled it into one of our first widely produced alcohols, and so we drank arat. Then it migrated from east to west, where it now commands a prominent position on the shelves of every grocer as ketchup. There could be a lot in a word, especially if that word is a food word. And so today we ask, what can food words teach us about ourselves and our history?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned in to the 987th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Giza Village who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Hey, I have a question for you, kind of like a trick question.
Okay, shoot.
Is it ketchup with a C or ketchup with a K?
It's a K.
It's a K. Okay, folks. At one time in my life, I was a sailor living on the high seas. The ship upon which I lived, the USS Bennington, was actually a small city with several thousand other residents, and we all had to be fed several times every day. Now, when the Benny was in port, our food was always fresh and actually quite good, all things considered. But when the Benny left port and sailed out into time, the food became, well, less interesting. Sometimes the Benny sailed way out in time, 40 days and more. And the more days she sailed out, the less interesting our food became. Now, standing in the mess lines, as we call them, I happened to notice a very interesting corollary between our time at sea and what the ship's menu writer had to say about what we were to eat that day. Now, when we were in or near port, the menu writer's description was always short, very terse. Get roast beef and potatoes, enjoy it. And, you know, being close to port, we sailors knew the food would be good, all things considered. But the farther we sailed out into time, the more elaborate and even braggadocio became the menu writer's descriptions. Herb-crusted top-loin roast with pan gravy, it would say. But having sailed far out into time, we sailors knew the food could not possibly be very interesting. You know, that memory came back to me when I picked up a copy of Dan Jaransky's The Language of Food. And so today we are going to open its pages and learn what food words can teach us about ourselves and our history. With us today we have Dan the man himself, Dan Jaransky, author of The Language of Food. Dan, welcome to the Food Chain.
Michael, it's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, you know, got to ask you, what the heck is a Stanford professor of linguistics do?
Well, linguistics is the scientific study of language. So we teach all sorts of courses related to language, and we do research on language. A lot of the work I do is on computational linguistics. So we study how to do automatic translation by machine or how to improve, you know, web search of the kind that you do in Google every day. So anything with language and computers, but you could study phonetics and how kids learn to speak, how sounds are produced in the mouth. You could learn about grammar. It's really a great topic for anybody who has a deep interest in language.
Well, back when I was a university student some years ago, my Chinese teacher was working on a computer program to translate Chinese into English. How far have we come in that ability?
Oh, we've come a long way. So for languages that are very close to English, like, very similar languages in their structure, like Spanish and English are actually very similar, and they even share a lot of vocabulary, the translations are actually quite good. If you go to the web and use Google Translate and translate a web page because you want to read a Spanish recipe or something, you can definitely read the recipe and make the dish. Chinese is harder. The structure of the language is much more different than English. and our ability to parse the Chinese is not as good as it is for languages closer to English. But it's still the case that, you know, when I'm reading a recipe and I'm confused about some words and I need to translate that sentence automatically from Chinese, it's very helpful.
And so we can get a rough idea, maybe, you know, do a little bit of our own translating of the translation and get to some place with it. I just think of Chinese, you know, you have a word like xian, which can mean any number of different things depending on the tone. And so you would have to have a pretty elaborate computer program to track all of those tones.
Absolutely. So when you're doing translation of text, you don't have to worry about the tones. You just have to worry about the characters. But if you're doing speech recognition of Chinese, yeah, now the tones really matter. And it's very tricky. And as a non-native speaker, sounds like for both of us as learners of Chinese, I find that the hardest thing, the tones.
The tones. Good enough.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, I was always fascinated while living on a Navy ship about the menu writer on the ship. Because the farther we would go out to sea, you know, the farther we got from fresh food, the more predictable the food would be, and then the more elaborate the language on the menu would be. And I was kind of tucked that away, and then I ran into your how to read a menu in the language of food. And I thought, there's an interesting parallel there, right?
Absolutely. So we've been studying the language of menus in a number of ways. So one way is we just took a lot of menus from restaurants where menus are posted online. So we took, in fact, 6,000 menus all the way across the U.S. and just looked at how the words they used depended on the fanciness or price of the restaurant. And we found very similar things to what you experienced on the sea. So just one little example, the cheaper the restaurant, the more likely the menu is to use the word you. So they'll say your way or any way you like them or your choice. But the more expensive the restaurant, the more they're talking about the chef. So they'll talk about the chef's choice or the chef's selection. So it's as if, you know, in an expensive restaurant, it's kind of like theater. You're going there to, you know, to pay for an expensive evening where the chef's going to show you something. The cheap restaurants really are about you making your choice. And you can see this difference in attitude. In, you know, it's right there clear in the language. But we also see exactly the kind of things that you noticed being close to port and far from port. So the fancier the restaurant, the more likely the restaurant is to want you to believe the food is going to be good, the less they say. The really fancy menus, very short descriptions about each dish. But it's the cheaper, like, you know, $2 sign, chain restaurants especially, lots of really long descriptions with all these beautiful adjectives. You know, fresh and rich and mild and crisp and I liked your herb crusted, all of that. That's what you see in these cheaper restaurants. So it's as if, you know, an expensive restaurant, they want the customer to assume the food is going to be good. And the customers are going to assume that because it's a fancy place. It's the cheaper places where they kind of have to protest too much. They've got to try to convince you that it's okay. And the very cheapest restaurants, they use words like delicious or tasty, these kind of vague, positive words. So they're not even positive. You'll believe it's delicious unless they tell you.
So if you see something that a restaurant menu says delicious, you got to think, well, why do they have to say it's delicious? It must be delicious because I'm going to pay money for it. I was wondering about the overuse of superlatives. Whenever I hear superlatives, you know, commercials especially use a lot of superlatives. But when I hear a lot of superlatives, I kind of go back to that menu notion as well. If you have to say it like that, maybe it isn't really.
Yeah, absolutely true. So, in fact, we did a study on superlatives. We looked at potato chip advertising. This was a great study. So I teach a freshman seminar. So freshman seminars, you know, these days kids are in these big lecture classes in college, and they don't get a lot of one-on-one with professors. And so almost all universities have established these freshman seminars where you get only 12 kids and the professor in a room trying to do something, advanced thinking, but with freshmen, you know, these are, you know, kids just out of high school. And so I did one on the language of food to get students interested in language and food. You know, with this generation of students, they're much more interested in food than, say, my generation was or, you know, my dad's generation. My dad's 91, and he doesn't talk about food. It's not something that men of his generation, you know, customarily talked about.
That's correct, but why? Oh, good. What a great question. This is.
It is a great question. it's
going to be way too much fun.
But you have
to hold on for a minute, Dan, because we just came to our first commercial break. But
oh my goodness,
this is going to be fun. Why did our parents not talk about food? Why did they not obsess with food the way we obsess with food with our language? And where does that language take us? And what does that language teach us about who we are and where we came from? Oh my goodness, we're going to talk about ketchup. We're going to talk about turkey. We're going to talk about toast and dessert and all kinds of fun things because we have Dan the Man with us today. Dan Jurevsky, who is the professor of linguistics at Stanford and also the author of The Language of Food. And we have you too. If you have a question about food words, pick up your phone, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
What about all of those superlatives we see on the menu? If they have to tell us food is super delicious, really, is it going to be super delicious? That's a question we have for Dan Jurevsky today, the author of The Language of Food. But before we get there, we ran into a very interesting parenthetical, and that is, why on earth did our parents not talk about food the way we do? We talk about food. Why were they not so obsessed, Dan?
You know, we just don't know that. I mean, it's probably cultural. You know, it could be that English don't talk a lot about food, and a lot of American early culture was established along English norms or the Dutch, and maybe more recently, you know, you've had a lot of immigrants from Italians and Chinese and lots of cultures in which it's totally normal for men to be cooks and talk about cooking. But, you know, we have no evidence that that's what's going on. It's definitely, everyone can see the change happening. Food is everywhere, and it makes sense, right? It's something that we all, it affects every single person many times a day. Why wouldn't we talk about it? Why wouldn't it be a natural part of daily life and conversation?
So we're talking about superlatives, and you were talking about teaching seminar classes with high school kids just out of high school into college. But they're smart kids, right? They're going to Stanford. So
they're great kids. And so I had this one kid, Josh Friedman, who was looking for ways to look at different language around food, and he had the idea of looking at the back of potato chip bags where there's lots of little advertising text. And you know, Josh, college freshman, not much money. So what does he do? He goes to the local Safeway and he takes pictures of the bags with his camera. He doesn't buy any of the potato chips, and he brings the pictures back to class, and we all look at the language. And then we looked at it in more detail over the years, and in the end we ended up buying some potato chip bags. But what we found is the more expensive the chip, the more likely they are to talk about the chip in comparison to other chips. So they would say what's not in this chip, but in other ones. So they would say no fluorescent orange or never fried. Or they would use comparatives like not like any other chip or better than other chips or the superlatives, best in America. So the more they use this language of comparison, the more they're comparing to other chips, it turns out the more expensive they were. It was only the more expensive chips that did this. And in fact, if you look at the number of times people use negatives and comparatives on a chip bag, every time you had one more word like no, you're paying 4 more cents per ounce for that chip bag. So you're really paying for that language.
And thus it is with the menus pretty much across the board when it comes to food. The more flowery, the more superlative the language, probably the less expensive the food then, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So it's actually kind of opposite. So in chips, you're paying more for the chip to tell you that it's different than the other chips. Menus is a little bit different, right? They're not comparing, you know, once you're at a restaurant, your menu's not going to talk about other restaurants. So comparing to other restaurants wouldn't make sense. So there we have kind of a different kind of advertising situation. Now you're sitting there reading their advertising while you're eating. So now it's their chance to tell you what's so great about their food, and the cheaper restaurants do that. The expensive ones want you to just assume it's great.
Well, as a linguist, why did you start picking on food words the way in which you did? I mean, you live in San Francisco. That has to have something to do with it, San Francisco being a great foodie city. But is that part of the reason you really focus your work and in your book, The Language of Food? Is that why you focus?
Well, I'm interested in food personally, and also, you know, with this class, food is a great way to get kids interested in language, because this generation of kids really is interested in food. But my interest really started with the one word ketchup. Linguists spend a lot of time in foreign countries learning languages. And so I was in Hong Kong learning Cantonese as a graduate student, you know, 20, 25 years ago. And everyone there knew that ketchup was a Chinese word. It was just obvious to everybody. The word jup in Cantonese means sauce. So ketchup just sounded like a Chinese word. It was obvious.
And ke is fish, right?
Well, it's complicated. So as you said, Chinese has lots of words that sound really similar with slightly different tones. So in modern Cantonese, ke means eggplant, and it also is a part of the word for tomato. So in modern Cantonese, it sounds like ketchup, sounds exactly like the words tomato sauce. So it's just obvious to everybody that it came from Cantonese. And so it turns out they were absolutely right that the word was Chinese. I was, you know, this American abroad, I'm convinced that they're wrong. This is our iconic sauce.
This is our stuff, yeah.
This is our stuff. Like, yeah, this can't be Chinese. And, of course, they were totally right. But they were wrong about the details of the etymology. So it turns out the word comes not from Cantonese, but from another Chinese dialect called Fujianese, where the word ge or gue meant a kind of salted fish. And the word is mostly died out of Fujianese now. So it's not there anymore. But in the 16th and 17th century, this was the common word for what we now, the fish sauce we still eat, you know, we think of as a Vietnamese or a Thai thing, the nok mum that you can just buy at Vietnamese stores or get in Vietnamese restaurants. That fish sauce was spread around Southeast Asia and was called by in this one Chinese dialect, it was called gedzup. And the story involves sailors, which is great. It's so great that your sailing background, your seagoing background. So imagine that instead of, you know, being in the 20th century or the 21st century, you're a sailor in the 17th century, and you're going on these very long, exactly these same kind of long sea voyages, and you're going to Asia, because in the 17th century, Asia was the great economic power in the world. So China was making porcelain, it was making textiles, and India is making cottons, Bengal is making cottons. So the Europeans are trying to get to Asia to get all of this stuff. And when they get, you know, what are they drinking on this on board ship? So this, they, you know, they have wine, they have beer. You know, it's hard to get fresh water. And the problem, you know, in the 17th century is that wine and beer go bad. So beer, to be preserved, often you add hops. So you make an IPA, a very hoppy beer. Hops are a preservative, but hops hadn't been added to beer yet. The English were still drinking ales, and there weren't hops in them yet. So the beers were going sour, and the wines weren't well casked, and they were going sour. And they get to Indonesia. They sort of get toward Asia. They get to Indonesia, and they find lots of local Chinese fish sauce makers making fish sauce and making soy sauce, but they were also distilling. So distillation, the technology of turning, you know, wine into alcohol, into spirits, you know, vodka and gin and whiskey, had been invented. The Chinese invented it, and the Arabs invented it, and Europe had kind of begun to start distilling, but it wasn't very common yet in England. It was a medicinal thing still. So when these English sailors arrive and see these Chinese distillers making this liquor called arak out of palm sugar, they're very excited because liquor doesn't go bad in the heat, and so they can mix it with water and it helps purify the water. So the British Navy buys thousands of barrels of arak from these Chinese distillers in Indonesia, and while they're there, well, they buy some barrels of the fish sauce on the side. And they bring all these bottles to Asia. They fill the bottles with fish sauce from Indonesia and then later from Vietnam and from Hong Kong. They bring it back to England. And what do you do when you have a really expensive imported product?
Cut it.
You get knockoffs. So there were knockoff ketchups, and they were made out of mushrooms, and they were made out of walnuts. Jane Austen's family has a walnut ketchup recipe. And then tomatoes came along around 1800, and they started adding tomatoes. And then maybe around 1860, the taste started to change, and what had been a salty, kind of savory, fishy sauce, we started adding sugar, especially in America, and especially as sugar became cheaper after the Civil War. So you start getting our modern sweet tomato chutney.
And there it is.
And there it is, all in the word, all in the name of the word. The word, the fact that the word is this Southern Chinese dialect word for fish sauce tells you the whole story.
And it's so amazing, you know, the journey a word can take you on. Now, one of the fascinating things about what you talk about is the influence of the Muslim world on our food, too. It seems like so much came out of the Muslim, the flowering of the Muslim culture. And I guess that's where I'd like to take us next. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson, with Dan Jurowski, who is the author of The Language of Food. Today we're taking words and asking them, where will you take us, Mr. Word? The word ketchup takes us from ancient China all throughout the Western world and ends up on the grocery shelves as ketchup, a whole bunch different than where it started off, but pretty much the same concept. It was a condiment then, and it's a condiment now. And when we come back, we're going to pick up different words. We'll take the word turkey, and we'll figure out why on earth a bird native to Mexico was named after a Muslim country in the Mediterranean. How on earth did that happen? We'll talk about desserts, and we'll talk about macaroons. We'll talk about all kinds of things and ask them, where will these words take us? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080.
Frank Muller has been farming in Woodland with his brothers Louie and Tom for as long as they can remember.
We've been farming since we were kids, but the college years at UC Davis were the big years. Because what we learned there, we brought home. Today, we're still working to make farming more productive and friendlier for the environment. Yeah, the future of agriculture looks good.
Find out how UC Davis partners with growers like the Mullers at onecalifornia.ucdavis.edu.
Well, folks, what's in a word? If the word is a food word, there could be hundreds and hundreds of years of history. That's what we're playing with today. We're picking up words from our food chain, words like ketchup. Oh, my goodness, what a history there. And Dan Jurowski, the author of The Language of Food, was talking about a Stanford linguistics class and how he is teasing the freshmen with words and using those words to open their eyes to the power and magic of language. And it kind of reminded me of a civics teacher I had way back when who used to bring in all of these tabloid magazines, and he'd pick up words and have us look at the words do you really believe what this is saying? And it's kind of like that with restaurant menus. Do you really believe it when the restaurant menu says delicious? So those are the things we're playing with today. And one word I'd like to pick up and run with, Dan, is the word turkey.
Turkey is a great word. So, you know, we just don't think about it very often. But you know, is it a coincidence that it has the same name as the country of Turkey? And it turns out it's not a coincidence at all. So the story, again, brings us back to history, tells us about history, and specifically about the relationship between East and West in world history. So let's go back to 1500. So where do you buy spices in 1500? You buy them in the city called Calicut, which is in Kerala on the coast of India. So black pepper from, you know, which is grown in India, comes down to Calicut to be sold. And first Muslim and Ottoman and Venetian traders are all trading with India and bringing the spices back to Europe. So Portugal is trying to break these monopolies. So they figure out, Vasco da Gama famously goes around Africa and gets to India the long way. And so they have their Portuguese kind of secret route to Africa that they don't want anybody else to know about. And they buy these spices, and they bring them to what's now the trading center of Northern Europe, which is Antwerp, you know, what's now in Belgium in Northern Europe. So they bring these spices, but they also, at the exact same time, they have Brazil, they have colonies in the New World, and they have colonies in West Africa. As they're sailing around Africa to get to India, their colonies in West Africa, which was called Guinea at the time, and they're getting gold from Guinea and ivory and also exotic birds. So they get this exotic bird that we now call the guinea fowl because of its comes from northern Africa all the way across to Ethiopia in the east and to West Africa. So, and this guinea fowl at the time was called the turkey cock because it was imported to Europe originally by the Ottoman Empire through Egypt. So this turkey cock is a small kind of black and white mottled bird. So all of these birds and gold and ivory and the turkey, you know, what we now call the turkey and the what we now call the guinea fowl, they're all being brought to Antwerp in these Portuguese ships. And Portugal was obsessed with naval secrecy. They didn't want anybody, you know, horning in on their colonies and their all their gold mines and whatever. So it was punishable by death to give out maps to foreigners. Nothing was published about exactly what their routes were. So when they brought these things to Antwerp, no one, sometimes not even the person who brought them in the end, knew where they'd originally come from. So these two birds, the turkey from America and the guinea fowl from Africa, are completely confused. And for 100 years, everyone, you know, a guinea fowl kind of looks like a small female turkey. Everybody's confused. No one has any idea that they're from different entire continents. And so even Shakespeare gets it wrong. In Henry IV, he talks about guinea fowls about turkeys, but he means guinea fowls. So by the time people had figured out that these were two separate birds, the kind of names had gotten swapped. And so the American bird we now call the turkey. So the turkey was very popular across Europe very quickly. So, you know, Columbus comes to America 1492. By 1505, there's turkeys, around Spain and Italy. By 1550, it's all across Europe, and it becomes the most popular bird for English Christmases and harvest festivals. So when the pilgrims come to America, they bring this tradition of turkey that they think of as an English thing, and they're kind of surprised to find, oh, look, there's, you know, they have wild turkeys in here, look, just like our English turkeys. What a coincidence.
And there they are.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, it's interesting to note how you talk about trade and spices, and it seemed to be that spices were the first impetus, really, for world trade, for people to go way out into the world.
Absolutely, yes, yes. I mean, if you think about... food really drives, we think about gold and silver and jewels, but really food has always been a great driver of travel and exploration. And I also like to say that innovation, we study, for example, in linguistics, we study the language of innovation, how scientific innovation travels. How do we come up with the words for a new scientific idea and how those ideas get borrowed by other people? And food is a great example of this. All of these foods that we talk about, like ketchup, they're products of people from one country kind of going to another, and then the food travels with them. These people meet and they kind of borrow the food from the neighbors and they modify it somewhat. And so the food is an impetus for this kind of change, this kind of world globalization, but it's also a product of it.
Did you talk a lot about that with respect to macaroni?
Yeah, another great story. So here's these words that sound similar, macaroons, and then there's the French word macaron that we now have, these fancy macarons, and macaroni, the pasta, and it turns out they are in fact the same word. So the word appears itself in Sicily in about 1279, macaroni, and it's really unclear what happens, but it looks like the word really referred to two separate things. The original macaroni wasn't the kind that we have now with the a tube with a hole in the middle. It was much more like what we now call gnocchi. So it was like lumps of dough with cheese. But pasta really developed in Sicily as a mixture again of stuff from the Arab world and stuff from the European world. So there was a Persian food called lausinaj, which was an almond pastry that was wrapped in dough. And this Persian food became very popular in Baghdad, and it was brought by the Moors to Sicily when they controlled Spain and Sicily. And so they had this you know, these really gooey, sweet desserts made out of almond paste. But also, Sicily was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. So they grew durum wheat in Sicily. And the Arabs had various kinds of noodles, often eaten in soup, very early on. So noodles are mentioned, you know, in Hebrew and Arabic sources very early in the 5th century. So these noodles and the durum wheat of Sicily combined to make what we now think of as pasta, the sort of hard, dried product. So it's made out of a wheat that can keep for a long time when dried. And so pasta and these sweet desserts made of almond paste kind of all arrived and all kind of developed together in this mishmash of European and Arab and North African culture. So macaroni means these two kinds of things. It means a gnocchi, and you can see the Arab origins. It's made with the original recipes all had rose water. They were sweet a little bit, so they had, you have rose water and egg whites and sugar and flour and cheese. Or the very earliest macarons are really kind of marzipan. So it's just almond paste, again, with rose water and egg whites and sugar. And the earliest recipes were wrapped in flour. So it was kind of a doughy thing, either made out of flour or made out of almond paste wrapped in flour. And then the word slowly began to split up into what we now would call a macaroni and what we now call a macaroon, which is a lighter, the original macaroon, just a lighter almond marzipan.
And I noticed in a lot of the recipes from the Muslim world, it talks a lot about rose water. And gosh, they used a lot of sugar too. Pick that up when we come back, folks. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Dan Jarofsky, author of The Language of Food and You. Stay tuned. So many of the delicious things we love to eat came out of the Muslim world way back when. And I happened to notice in Dan Jarofsky's book, The Language of Food, that a lot of the recipes used rose water and, of course, lots of sugar. But rose water, what did rose water do for food?
Well, I think rose water is just a flavoring. You know, you think of any of the spices that we use. In the Middle Ages, it was just very common to use lots more spices. Our palate was much closer to, say, what Indian food is now than what, say, English food is now. People just ate more spicy food, and that was true of the salty food, so, you know, lots of cumins and cinnamons, but also true of the sweet food. So we had rose water and orange flower water. It was just a more fragrant period, I guess.
And was that because of the quality of food back then? Of course, you know, fresh food didn't last very long back then, as long as it does with refrigeration now. So it probably had a lot to do with you needed to have a lot of spices. Is that true?
Nobody really knows, but people, historians now think that it's not true. So, you know, I was brought up saying that, you know, they told me in school that, oh, in the Middle Ages, you know, meat went bad, so you had to mask it, and that's why they had such spicy food in the Middle Ages. But really, some cuisines have spicy food and some don't. I call this the grammar of cuisine. What a particular person at a particular time finds to be tasty is really a fact about culture. And certainly there are facts about food safety that play a role. So, for example, in China, nobody eats raw food. You wouldn't eat, historically, say, you wouldn't eat salad. There's no historical idea of salad in China. And everything is boiled. Water is boiled. If you drink a glass of water in China, they would boil it first. And that's, of course, arose for health reasons. But in general, the idea that some cuisines, you know, like spicy food, so in you know, India has spicy food, and the west of China, Sichuan, has spicy food, but the south, Canton, has no spicy food. It's really a cultural thing, and I think somehow in the Middle Ages, Europe had this idea that these spices were how food should taste, and you know, it was exciting, and food was interesting, and then somehow things changed, and by about the 1600s, they began to substitute local herbs, you know, thyme and rosemary and things that could actually grow in Europe, and the demand for these exotic spices began to go down.
I have a friend who's a professional baker, and he talked recently about having baked a loaf of bread using only flour, salt, and water. And I, by golly, there it is in the language of food, too. So you talk about flour and salt.
Yeah, flour and salt have some great linguistics in addition to their great properties. So they actually tell us these two words actually have a message for us about health. So I'll start with flour. So flour was actually a French word. So it came into English from French when the Normans invaded England. So the Anglo-Saxon word that we used to use for the what we now call a flower was a blossom. So we still have the word blossom. But flower didn't just mean the flowery part of a plant. It meant the best of anything. So you have these old-fashioned phrases like the flower of chivalry, right, or modern phrases like fleur de sel for the fluffy part of the salt from sea salt. So right after the Normans arrive in England, in the 13th century, they start using the phrase flour of wheat or flour of meal. And what they mean by that is the white part. They mean the endosperm, the carbohydrate part, without the bran, without the germ. So only the rich people could afford, you know, really white flour, which they got by sifting out the bran, sifting out the germ. So, the thing they're calling the best part of the wheat is, of course, the part that's worse for you. And this idea that the refined foods are better, we think of it as a modern illness. But, you know, it's been that way. We've been talking about the refined foods as the flower of the product since the 1300s. It's like 800 years now, 700 years that we've been eating unhealthily.
Fooling ourselves, right? Yeah.
It's totally, yeah. But it's there. That's the thing about the language of food. We're surrounded by these cues to how we're thinking and what our history is. And if you just kind of open your eyes, it's there in the words. It's there on the menus. It's all around us.
Dessert.
Another good one. So I was talking a second ago about the grammar of cuisine, you know, what makes some cuisines different than others. So we have dessert. So what's dessert? Dessert doesn't just mean sweet things. If I go out and I have a Snickers bar, that's not dessert, that's just a snack. To be dessert, you have to be at the end of the meal. Dessert is a sweet thing, that's the final course. And we didn't always eat dessert. So, Middle Ages, there's all these great dishes like rabbit in sugar and ginger, or lamb in lemon and honey sauce. So the idea that sweet things should come at the end, the word dessert, for example, English borrowed it from French very late, like the late 1700s. So, and it seems like the French got this idea of a sweet thing at the end. They got it from the Spanish, who got it from the Moors, who got it from Baghdad, who got it from the Persians. So it all dates back to the Persians. And in fact, 500 BC, Herodotus, the Greek historian, he's writing about the Persians, and he says, the Persians, they really love dessert. There's something about dessert that they have millions of kinds of dessert, and Herodotus says, the Persians, they mock the Greeks, because the Greeks, they don't really have anything, they don't have this concept of dessert, and so they're like, why even go eat a Greek meal in 500 BC, because there's no dessert. So this idea took hold and got relatively recently, and now we don't eat the sweet things in the middle of the meal, we eat them at the end. But there are cuisines like China where there's historically no word for dessert. So there's a word in Mandarin, tian dian, that means sweet things, but really that's like Snickers bars and donuts and little cakes you could eat any time of day. They don't mean at the end of a meal.
And thus they don't serve dessert. Folks, when we come back, I'm going to close up the show with one very interesting notion that Dan brings up at the very end of his book, which would be dessert after you've cleared the table. We have something else to talk about, and that's the whole notion of group cooking. Do you cook with other people? Well, that's a notion we're going to put on the table. This is The Food Chain, Michael Lowes with Dan Jurafsky, the author of The Language of Food. What's in a word? Well, if the word is a food word, there could be hundreds of years of history and an insight into the way we were and to the way we are now. That being the lesson of The Language of Food from Dan Jurafsky, who is a professor of linguistics at Stanford University. Dan, you ended your book with an epilogue on group cooking. Why?
Well, the story I tell, I was on sabbatical once in the area of Spain where they still speak Basque. And they have this idea of a cooking club. They call them choco. And a cooking club is, it was like a 19th century idea originally of these clubs for men where they would get together and they'd cook group dinners. And now,
kind of like the firehouse, right?
Yeah. It's again, we talked about it earlier that it's not so common for men historically in our culture to bond over cooking and talking about food. But in the Basque culture, it's very, you know, public group cooking is a very common thing. And there's a group and there are names for this. And there, you can rent these public, you know, we have public parks with tennis courts, and they have public parks that have public kitchens that you can rent and have a party at. And what I like about group cooking is really it's a metaphor for how to live. You know, everybody's bringing their stuff, you know, literally to the table, their ingredients, their culinary, their family spices, their history. And I think this idea, it's kind of a stone soup idea. That's what underlies our culture. We think of our culture as something that is, you know, created out of itself and unique and different than everyone else. And that also, it is true that we create these unique things, that we create them because, you know, America is a stone soup country. We all came from different places, and we each bring our foods and our culture. And you can see, like, in the history of ketchup, these things change over time, and we're creating these new things by borrowing from all sorts of different cultures and building a new thing together. So it's really a group effort. That's the story.
Out here in the world, we listen to you, and we think, gosh, that's all very interesting, but how do we go about getting a hold of a word and letting it take us on a trip?
Well, you know, my the first piece of advice I always give somebody if they want to know more about a word is to go look at the dictionary. So my favorite dictionary is the Oxford English Dictionary, which you can get at any library, you can get online, and it has amazing etymology. So that I first found the story of ketchup by looking there, and it turns out, you know, the editor of the Oxford English Dictionary read these early Chinese dictionaries in 1870 and 1880, and he figured this out. So that's a great source. But really, any dictionary will, if you look up the history of a word, you'll be amazed by the things you find.
What did you find? All of your study, when you consider it all, you know, you're a PhD in linguistics. What did you find when you dug into language?
Well, I mean, maybe the biggest lesson you find is our similarities and our differences. You know, linguists are kind of, we're obsessed with understanding what makes all languages similar, what's in common from language to language. And when you look at the language of food, you see you can find evidence for all these commonalities, things that lots of cultures do that turn out to be very similar. You can see that reflected in the words. My study of menus, it turns out that people have mailed me from Finland and from Spain and in England, and all the same kind of language things are happening in these kind of menus too. So we all have some deep human commonality, and we all have these cultural differences too. And so it's the combination of the cultural differences and the combined humanity. That's maybe the last lesson of the language of food.
And it is what makes life interesting, right? Well, folks, thank you for tuning in. Thank Dan Jarafsky, professor of linguistics, Stanford, author of The Language of Food. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain: agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.